Fixture. And now it is my pleasure to introduce my friend, all the way from Exeter, Alan.
My name's Alan. I'm an alcoholic. And I've been telling myself for about a week or so, it's no big deal. You've done this before, but I'm pretty freaking nervous. So I don't know why. But, yeah, I know. And so anyway, I see Johnny O back there. I would thank you all for coming, but you're probably coming anyway, so... Anyway, my name's Alan. I'm an alcoholic. I have a birthday this week. The flyer said that I'd already be 37 years old, but I'm really, that's not till Friday. May 18th is my sobriety date. And I have a real great thing going on in my life right now. And that is that I got a sponsee down here, and he's got a year this week. And that's David. And that's been a really good thing. Well, I was born at a really early age. Yeah. Anyway, I was born into a family that they weren't drinkers. They were, both my parents came from South Dakota. They were Norwegian Lutherans from the Middle West. They came out to San Diego during World War II to work in the airplane factories and stuff. And they met out here. They didn't meet back there, but they met out here and, they got married and stayed in San Diego, and that's where I grew up. They were nice people. They didn't drink. They didn't smoke. They didn't cuss. They rarely laughed. They weren't cruel or mean people, but we went to church every Sunday. We said grace before every meal. I went to bed with some prayer that rhymed. I think that's why I like writing songs now. I had a bunch of brothers and sisters. I was number three, and then after I arrived, they just kept adding to this family. So I ended up with seven brothers and sisters, and I don't know, something snapped in me at about 4 or 5 years old. It seemed like I was just going along being a real happy kid and, you know, love my parents, love my brothers, all that kind of stuff. And then it just seemed like I got this weird thing. Probably saw something on television or something, I don't know. But I just got kind of angry about everything. And then soon after that, I got really aware of... And it probably was, I was born in December, so I started school almost a year after everybody else. You know, they had this cutoff line, so I was about a year older than all these other kindergartners. And I think probably just a little bit of stuff you learn in that extra year makes you a little brighter than all these other kids. And so somehow I got the idea that I just knew what was going on and knew better than everybody else. And then shortly after figuring that out, I started finding out how I could get away with doing as little as possible for whatever. So I've never really got the bug to be excel in school or any of that kind of stuff. I just really, I didn't get in a lot of trouble in school. I just always just did enough to get by and keep passing on to the next grade and all that stuff. But I never applied myself to anything. And I had all this natural kind of ability. I was sort of like a parrot or something, you know, that I could pretend to be something and I could almost pull it off for a while until I got a little older and you had to start learning how to apply yourself and get disciplined and all that stuff. And then I just became kind of Mr. Rebel Artist something in high school and all that, you know, class officer, football, wrestling, all the sports, all that stuff just kind of went out the window, and I started playing Bob Dylan records, and I just decided that You know, I had this racist seventh grade teacher, and he was also a Lutheran. I don't know if he was Lutheran. He was a Norwegian, though, and he thought Norwegians were the best thing since sliced bread. And he took me aside one day, and I think it's because I was another Norwegian. But he was trying to get me motivated. He was trying to get me to apply myself and live up to my potential and all this stuff. And he told me that day, he said, you know, he could take 100 kids and I would be smarter than 90 of them. And it really just had the reverse effect on me. I thought, well, if I'm so fucking smart, I don't have to do anything. And I'll always get by and I'll always have it made. So that delusion started about then. And I was a total washout. You know, a few years ago, I guess it was after my dad died, and we were moving my mom out of this place, and they had all that stuff they saved from our childhoods, and I came across all these report cards. And if you would have asked me how I did in high school, I would have told you, oh, you know, I got C's and C's, maybe some D's, but I probably was a C student, and I got by and went on to the next grade and all that. But that isn't really what it was. I had so many D's and D minuses, it wasn't even funny, and I was a charity case. People passed me, you know, just to so I wouldn't come back and be in their class next time, I guess. So anyway, but I had this ridiculous idea that I was something special, that there was something really, really special about me. And the longer I lived, the more I kept getting the message from everybody else that that wasn't true. And then I started getting kind of pissed off at all of you people and just started figuring you're all a bunch of morons anyway. And I kept telling myself for a long, long time that how I was just this misunderstood genius. And one day my ship would come in and everybody would realize how important I was, and all my dreams would come true. And that went on for a long time. Let's see. Anyway, like I said, my parents didn't drink or smoke or any of those things, and they were nice people. They were honest people. They were hardworking people. I couldn't fault them on anything, really. And the minute I started doing all my smoking and cussing and all that kind of stuff when I was younger, that started up this double life thing with them. And then I'd go do that stuff out there, but when I came home, pretty much just shut down emotionally and hardly communicated with them at all. And there's no reason. I can't blame them for me being an alcoholic. There's something about the way I see life that was just screwed up from a very, very early age. I remember terrorizing. I had a couple younger sisters, and I was so angry that I was just this monstrous asshole all summer long, and my mother would just be driven up the wall by me teasing them, making fun of their appearance, doing all these kinds of things that just, I sometimes I wonder if I had any effect on their self-image or not. I hope not, but I was just a real jerk, I guess. But it was drunk on this sort of sense of power I got from that kind of thing. There was a neighbor down the street, Mr. Storr, and he was an old retired Navy guy, and he had this beer keg, and he had this the king of Little League come over to his house every day, and they would drink beer. And he wasn't a violent asshole drunk. He was just a mellow, nice guy, and he used to drive us down to La Jolla Shores and leave us there all day. And I got to go to the beach a lot, not because my parents took me to the beach, but because Mr. Storr took me to the beach. And he had... There was something about the way he drank beer and the way he was such a nice, mellow guy that was very appealing to me. Now, I don't know what that has to do with anything, but that was about the only experience I had with alcohol growing up. Somewhere along high school, I had a few drinks, I smoked a little pot, and it's like I discovered my answer, you know. I had been this kind of weird, nervous, wrecked, self-conscious, frightened. I was so frightened at life that's, you know, looking back, I know that's the reason I checked out. That's the reason I never applied myself to anything. That's the reason I never pursued anything. That's the reason I never made any effort toward anything positive. I just didn't know how to break out of this self-consciousness or this anxiety that I felt. And I was good enough to just fake it, and I was good enough to kind of go under the radar, and they didn't do a lot of testing for mental illness back then, so no one ever found me out, I guess. And so I just went on, and life went on, and I graduated from high school. I had picked up a habit of drinking wine and beer with my friends on the weekends, and they were guys like me who liked to get drunk and liked to play guitars and stuff like that. And I had this girlfriend that I met at the church group, and we started dating in high school, and that relationship lasted about 3 years, longer than it should have, mainly because her father had one of those beer tapper things, and he didn't mind me coming over and pouring beer down my throat. So if I brought my guitar and sang Hank Williams songs, I could drink all the beer I wanted. So it was pretty cool. And it was really a sad day when we broke up, because I really missed that guy. But after that, my drinking, I got my big break. I was a wannabe songwriter guy, and I thought that was going to be my ticket out, and I was writing all these country songs about a life that I wasn't really living. It was just pretend, kind of stuff. And I had this little group with my brother and another guy, and we played around and did these auditions and things like that, and did that for a while. And then everybody started kind of growing up and going into real jobs and everything. And I got my big break. I knew somebody, and I got a job as a janitor at a high school. And I started doing that job, and that was a great job for me, because I didn't have to be to work till 3 in the afternoon. I could go around. It kind of fit right into my misunderstood genius little scenario. I would say, here I am stuck in this janitor job, but I'm really this gifted guy and all this stuff, The truth was, I wasn't even a good janitor. I was damn lucky to have the job. I didn't know anything about cleaning toilets or anything, or giving a shit about anything. But luckily, I had a paycheck at the end of the month all the time, so I paid the rent and I wasn't out on the streets, And somehow I got some credit cards and I abused those for a while, and it seemed like everything was going all right. My drinking, I did a lot of drinking alone, and then there were periods of time where I might stop at some bar and hang out at a bar and do that kind of thing for a while. But I would say, if I was to look at most of my drinking after about age 22 or 3, after I quit hanging out with those friends of mine that played music and stuff, I would say it was all alone, just me, drinking, smoking pot. One of the things I like to do is, write my songs, sing into a tape recorder, or smoke a joint and listen to me. And I did stuff like that. I'm still doing it. I just don't smoke joints. But... Yeah, that's right, progress. Life went on, and I didn't get into a lot of trouble. I'm probably leaving a lot of things out. I hung out, my older brother was a few years older than me, and I moved in with him for a while, and I remember there was a lot of partying going on there, but it was by the college and stuff, and so I did a lot of drinking. I had a lot of what seemed like fun. And then about at age, I was about 27, I guess, 27 or 28, I was leaving this bar one night, and I think the accident happened because I was driving along with a beer up like this, and I looked down, and this car was stopped right in the middle of the road, and I was really wasted, and I didn't have anywhere to turn or anything like that, because there was just parked cars, and then this guy was stopped. And the two cars, people were talking to each other. And I plowed into the back of this, it was a big Chevy or something. I was driving one of those little mini Honda cars. And I didn't do much damage to them, but my car, I didn't have my seatbelt on. So what happened is I whacked my head on the thing that holds the windshield. And luckily, it was about a block away. There was a hospital, so the cops showed up, and they took me down there, and I got stitched up. And while I was there, they took a blood test, and I got charged for drunk driving about a month later in the mail. So I didn't go to jail that night. They just sent me home with my stitched up head. And then at that point, it was like 1977. It was nothing like it is nowadays. Nowadays they have, I guess, right after I came in last time, they start all this Mothers Against Drunk Driving stuff, and penalties started getting a lot stiffer and all that stuff. But I remember I went to court, and it was a $300 fine for that first offense. And I don't think they took a license or anything. They didn't do anything like that. They just gave me a fine, told me not to come back. And about 6 months later, I was down on that same road, and I went screaming across the pavement, almost lost control of that, and a cop happened to be watching me do that, and that was my first trip to jail. And he took me down to a drunk tank, San Diego County Jail, and I don't know, I was really kind of just drunk, so I don't remember a lot about it, except it seemed to me like a room was about as big as this room, and it was just full of people, and that's about all I remember about that. I remember they had these picnic table kind of things, and drinking coffee out of these weird, like, cereal bowls and shit. And I remember just climbing under the thing. I just crawled under the table and just slept there all night. And then I got out in the morning, and that day I walked on home, and I went by my parents' house, and I kind of felt like, well, they're going to find out about this second one anyway, so I might as well tell them the truth about what's going on in my life, because I've been keeping all this stuff a secret. And I went over to talk to my dad, and I kind of expected some kind of lecture. I expected him to tell me what a dumbass I was and all that kind of stuff, all the stuff I was telling myself. And he was surprisingly just very, very understanding, and about all he had to say about it was that some guy in Lawrence Welk's band had a drinking problem, and that if there was anything he could do for me, you know, they'd want to help me whatever I needed, you know. So it was nothing like I expected. But after that, I also went to my first AA meeting. The lawyer that my brother had used said it'd be a good idea if I went to some AA meetings, got some court slip signed before I went to court, because it'd look good when I went to court. So I did that, and I went down to this noon meeting down in El Cajon, California. And the amazing thing was, I really liked the atmosphere in that. It was kind of like the Alano Club noon meetings, or like they used to be. I haven't been there in a long time, but you know, a whole lot of people with court slips like me, and there were a few old timers that were there to carry the message and put on the coffee and all that. I remember Scotty and Vera. They got around. I saw them at some drunk driver's school thing later on a panel too. I remember. And then there were, you know, that was just a real interesting group of people. There was some priest that had been kicked out of the Catholic Church for being a drunk, and he had this hippie girlfriend, and there was this guy named Vince, who was sort of like a Charlie Manson of AA or something. He just, and he was, had these followers, they'd follow him in, and I don't know how, where he went, but he was scary, really. He was intense, but it was a real interesting group of people, and there was something about the irreverent sense of humor, the honesty just blew me away. People got up on these podiums and talked about these tragedies, these feelings they had, things that I've never heard people share like that before. I'd never heard that in any school or church or anything like that, or hanging out with my friends. People really talking about things that they were experiencing in life, what they were afraid of, what they are ashamed of, what they are guilty about, what the law was doing to them, what these people were taking their kids away. All these things were happening, and they were just talking about them up and open in the meetings. And I remember that blew me away. And what kind of happened for me is I stayed there, and I kept going to the meetings. I liked them, and I decided I was going to be sober. And I had no idea what this powerlessness stuff was, what they talked about in a big book about having this obsession of the mind, the phenomenon of craving and all that. I didn't know anything about that. I just knew that I did understand that I'm one of these people that shouldn't be drinking, that I'm never going to be able to do it successfully. So I thought my way to handle this would be, I'll just smoke pot. And, you know, I got a haircut and a couple new shirts, and I started my new life. And I went almost 2 years just smoking pot, and I became this weird paranoid pothead guy, you know. Just to walk through a checkout line at a grocery store was a big traumatic experience for me, you know. And I was sitting by the pool at this apartment complex where I lived, and there were a couple guys down there drinking beers. And it had been a couple years, and I'd long since quit going to AA. Oh, yeah, I quit going to AA because I thought maybe I'd go to one of these nighttime meetings. And I went up to this nighttime meeting, and it wasn't the noon meeting I was used to. It was about... you know, it was about four or five guys in there, and they looked like Mike and like me and like Brett back there with his gray hair and Matt, you know. You look like that, and they're all sitting there, and they had cigarettes and sitting around this table. And I looked in that window, and I go, shit. And I tried to imagine myself going in there and sitting down with these four or five guys and getting that intimate with these people I didn't know and I didn't have any interest in and all that stuff. It scared me. It wasn't like going to a meeting and waving something and saying, I'm here because I got to get this signed. You know, I had to go in there and say, I don't know how to live my life and I need help. And I had to do it with these five guys, you know. So that's when I had my epiphany. I said, fuck it. I'm out of here, and I left. And I went on. I did pretty good, just smoking pot and going to my janitor job and all that stuff. And that was my second one, so I had lost my license for a year. But I was getting rides to work and stuff like that, and everything was working out all right. But anyway, back to the swimming pool. I was down there, and I lived in one of those apartment complexes, like those big motels, you know. They had just this hallways full of doors, you know, that kind of thing. And most of them kind of looked out over the swimming pool. Mine was out on the end and looked out over the parking lot. And that's where I'd smoke my dope and stare out into the future about, you know, this wonderful life that's going to come along someday and all that stuff. But anyway, I was down by the pool, and the guy offered me a beer, and I took that beer, and all of a sudden this weird paranoid pothead guy turned into a regular guy, and I started talking about sports and motorcycles and shit, and I said, hey, this is great. And I was heading back up to the store to buy another 12-pack, and I got up there, and I remember consciously saying to myself something like, you know, why you been torturing yourself? This is the only shit that really makes you feel good. Go for it, you know. So I went up, and I got that stuff, and I came back, and then I don't know if they were celebrating me coming out of my apartment or what, but they decided to have some kind of potluck thing, and everybody went to get their hot dogs and hamburgers and chips and stuff. So I went up to the store, and I bought my contribution, which was a pint or a half pint of some kind of a whiskey kind of thing. And I remember bringing it back and sitting down at this picnic table, and I hand up my, you know, hand over, you want to hit, you know, one of those things, and I hand my booze over to this, the next guy, and he takes it, and it goes all the way around the table. No one drinks any of it, you know, and it comes back to me. And so anyway, I finished that thing up, and I got all shit-faced drunk and made a total ass out of myself with my new friends, and they all told me the next day, you know, how much fun I'd had and everything, because I didn't remember much of it. I had these vague memories of bouncing off this bay window and being aware that I was using all this filthy language in front of some little kid, you know, and stuff like that. That's about all I remember about that night. But that kind of kicked off my last year of drinking. And my last year of drinking was I had this experience with AA. I'd, you know, a couple months of going to meetings and hear people talk about the disease and all that. And I had a big book, and I'd read some of the stories and all that kind of thing. So I had this knowledge that I was an alcoholic. I pretty much bought into that idea. I didn't know the weight of it or anything, but I knew that's what I'd call myself. And I had my own version of one day at a time, which was, well, maybe tomorrow I'll do something about it. Today I'm going to get fucked up. So I went on like that until I got caught driving out away from some bar one night, and I forgot to put my lights on, of course, and they pulled me over. And it was at the time when the famous lawyer F. Lee Bailey had refused to take all the tests. And, of course, he's rich and smart and everything, so he got off, but it didn't work so well for me. And I I refused to take all the tests. I figured, I'm either going to lose my license for 3 years or the DMV is going to take it for 6 months. So I had 6 months better than 3 years. But what I didn't know was the DMV thing was totally different. It wasn't part of the courts. The DMV is the DMV. You take the test or we take your thing for 6 months. The court says, you're stupid, you're poor, and you're drunk. And if the cop says you're drunk, you're guilty. So that's what I got. What happened later was kind of funny because I got the alternative sentence. I got to save my driver's license, but I had to give it up for 6 months because of my legal advice I gave myself. So anyway, that's enough of that story. After that year, I got the last drunk driving, and I went to court, and the court seemed to go pretty good because I'm not sure why. I had the alternative sentencing coming, so part of it was sending me to AA. But I'm forgetting the big part. You know, I'm supposed to tell you what I was like, what happened, and what it was like now, and I just skipped over the what happened. So here's what happened. I was sitting around for that court date waiting about a month because I knew I was going to have to spend at least a couple weeks in jail on this third offense. And I was really worried about that. I'd never really actually lived in jail before. I just spent the night a couple times. So the idea of living in jail was scary for me. And so I was scared for a month, you know. And I was just waiting for that court date to come. And I was going to meetings and same reason as before. So it looked good when I went to court. And I was still drinking a little bit, still smoking a little dope, but I was going to these meetings in the daytime and going to my janitor job at night and worrying about this court date. And it was a Saturday night for the Monday when I went to court, and I was up at this bar that was walking distance from my house. And usually I was the kind of guy that drank beer and smoked pot. And if I added tequila or whiskey to it, I got real mouthy and crazy, and people started throwing me out of bars and stuff like that. I thought it was clever, but I guess they call it obnoxious. But anyway, that's kind of drunk I was. And that night I went up there and I started drinking these whiskey drinks, so whiskey and water or something like that. And then instead of getting, you know, mouthy and clever and all that, I just got more and more depressed and more into the reality of my life. And I went home that night, and I got up the next morning, and I had this hangover that just ached all over. And I was going to drink some beer to mellow out, but I couldn't even swallow the stuff. And it all hit me, who I was, what I'd become, where I was. And I realized that morning, you know, that the stuff they were talking about in AA, maybe it would work for me. I'd been taken to church all my life, and all I ever got out of it was that it was all a big insurance policy for the afterlife, that if I said the right prayers at the right time, I'd be able to con myself through the pearly gates when it was all over, you know. But that morning, I saw it as a different thing. I saw it that I was sitting there. I was this 30-year-old neurotic teenager who hadn't done shit with his life, who was afraid of everything, didn't have any real relationships. He was a total failure in his life, and there was no big reason for it because, I mean, I wasn't stupid. I wasn't a genius, I tried to tell myself, but I was like a guy that had some gifts and some abilities and stuff, and for some reason, I couldn't make the simplest shit work. I couldn't form a true relationship, a true partnership. I couldn't enter into a marriage, have kids, have a family, have a career. I couldn't do any of that stuff. And other people that seemed like real dumbasses were doing this stuff. So I realized that morning that, you know, it was right here, right now, in this life, I needed the help from this higher power. That I needed more than I had to make this life work. And I got down on my knees for the first time in my life and got real with this higher power. And I realized that, yeah, I'm one of these alcoholics. You know, my top priority in life is being fucked up. When I start drinking, nothing else counts. Nothing else matters. There's all kinds of other stuff that's wrong with me besides my alcoholism. There's something that makes my life so uncomfortable that alcohol makes me feel better. And the way I see things, the lies I tell myself, all that stuff. So I could see that morning that I was a real mess and I couldn't make it unless I, first of all, foremost, you know, got free from this alcohol thing. So I asked God to just give me what it would take to stay sober, whether I went to court and went to jail and whatever else. I just asked for what I needed to stay sober and to move on with this sober life. And, you know, like I said, the court thing went pretty good. The judge was an alcoholic, too. He lived over in the beach area, but he, everybody knew about it, you know, Judge Baird. And he was a member of AA and been in AA for many, many years. And he gave me another chance. And he put me in that alternative sentencing program, and I got to go watch Father Martin movies and learn about alcoholism. And the best thing about that whole treatment thing was they had one requirement. To make it through that year and to get your sentence thrown out or whatever, all you had to do is show up to this meeting every week. And they didn't even have blood tests or anything. You just had to not get caught being fucked up. And you just had to show up. And we started with about 40 people in that class, and by the end of the year, there were about 7 of us. And all the people had to do was show up every week, and they would have been able to stay out of jail or whatever, and no one was able to do that, except a few of us. And it only happened for me because God had answered that prayer. I didn't know it at the time, but he changed me from the back row wise guy to the front row student, and I started coming to these AA meetings and sitting up front and listening to every clown up here on the podium as if they were big experts on alcoholism. And they were. They had their experience, and they shared it with me. And they told me to work the steps to get a sponsor and get into service and a bunch of other stuff that I didn't understand. But they kept talking, and I kept talking, and I kept coming back to meetings. And my first sponsor got me up through the amends steps, and then I switched over to another guy who was real big on service and all that. So he had a speaker's meeting that was sort of like this. It was the big event of the week down there in Elko. It was AA date night, you know. And I got to come up to that and set up chairs for that, and once in a while be the MC and all that. And we had a little study group before that, and we'd read the big book, and we didn't discuss it. My sponsor said, if we stop and discuss it, we'll just pollute the hell out of it. So I want you to hear what it says, so we're just going to read it. So we would take 2 pages, and, you know, well, that's what we do. We'd read the big book, and we did that a long, long time, a bunch of years. My sponsor was great. He was he used to pick me up, and we'd get in his car, and it was San Diego, so there were meetings all over this big city, and you could go way across town and all that stuff, and we spend more time in the car than we did in AA meetings, and I got to know him real well, he got to know me real well, and he taught me a hell of a lot of stuff about living my life that has proved to be very invaluable for me. You know, he pointed me to that service thing, and he told me that I had to learn to make commitments, and I had to learn to be where I said I was going to be. And even though that stuff seemed silly to me, it started paying off when I started looking for a job and trying to find a career to get into and stuff like that, you know. When I became responsible, when I started doing things just because I said I was going to do it and all that. I remember that time I was 15 minutes picking him up, 15 minutes late picking him up. And I drive up there, and we were going to some meeting or something, and he's yelling at me and giving me the third degree about being 15 minutes late. You said you'd be here, and blah, blah, blah. I said, geez, you crazy old bastard, what's this big deal? We're just going to a meeting. You know what? You know, what do you do with your life anyway? I'm 15 minutes late, big deal. And he just, but anyway, he hollered at me, and he told me that stuff about being where you say you're going to be, when you're going to be there, and all that. And for some reason, I started showing up on time everywhere. So I guess it worked. I remember another time when I was telling him what a shitty sponsor he was. He invited me to go ahead and find a different one. And the thought of not having him in my life scared the shit out of me. And I said, no, I was just kidding. But yeah, that was a real great thing, you know. And then at one point he suggested maybe I ought to go back to school. And I said, are you kidding? I couldn't even imagine that. And but after he died, or sometime when he was on his way out, he got that dementia kind of stuff. So he kind of faded out for a couple of years. But But somewhere around there, I decided I was going to go back to school, and I wanted to get a job doing the kind of stuff I wanted to do, and I wanted to have the learning it required to go say, you know, I'm entitled to have this job kind of thing. So I went back, and I got my degree in English literature and journalism and stuff, because I like writing, so I thought I was going to major in that, because some other AA friend of mine told me, whatever you do, don't do this one class here, one class there, or whatever. Go get into it, make that full time, get yourself a goal and work toward it. And luckily, because I didn't have any dependents or anything, I was able to do that, so it was pretty easy for me, really. But I went back to school and I did that, and I found out it was just like an AA meeting. If I sat up front, if I listened to what they said, if I took notes, if I asked questions, things started happening, and I became knowledgeable. And I graduated. I did really well. And then about that time, my AA experience told me, you know, this whole idea of passing on something that's been given to you is a pretty cool thing, and it's pretty great to be able to share my story and all that in an AA meeting. I thought, well, maybe I'd be a pretty good teacher. You know, maybe I could teach other clowns like me that have no interest in school, and maybe I could find a way to get to them because I relate to them and all that. I was wrong, of course. I probably would have been pretty good teaching old 40-year-old drunks who are getting sober, but kids never took to me so well. Just a few of them probably, but I had a good time, and I got to be a school teacher for about 20 years, and I got to retire a couple years ago, and that's what brought me up here to the San Joaquin Valley. Was a first teaching job out at Tulare Western, and I taught out there, and I ran the school newspaper, and I tell you, that's if any of you are interested in being a school teacher, that's what you do. You go into your first interview and you tell them, I'd really love to be the advisor for the school newspaper. And they'll hire you because no one else wants to do that. It's kind of like being an alcohol treatment counselor. But anyway, life has been really, really good. I still go to meetings. In fact, since I retired a couple years ago from the school teacher thing, I started going to more meetings, and for some reason a few people have asked them to maybe to sponsor them again. I hadn't sponsored anyone in a long time, it seemed like, and getting to be in the book and help people work through their steps for the first time, and it's very gratifying not only to watch them grow and to get in touch with who they really are and their need for a higher power and an appreciation for AA, but also it's looking through another person's eyes at my own issues, I guess you call them, has been real educational and real eye-opening in a lot of ways. It continues. I continue to figure out who I am in the scheme of things. I know that there was some study done way back when Alcoholics Anonymous was new, and they said they wanted to find out what personality traits would define the typical alcoholic, drunk or sober. And they studied a bunch of these drunks, and they found out that the three unifying characteristics, the three things that tied them all together, the three things they had in common, were their emotional sensitivity, the grandiosity, and what's the other one? Jeez. The grandiosity, emotional sensitivity. Huh?
Memory.
Yeah, memory. Oh man, that's really disappointing here. Yeah, it goes along those lines. Anyway, no one's going to remember this anyway, so who gives a shit? But no, it's but anyway, the grandiosity and the emotional sensitivity, I just recently started kind of seeing all that stuff in me that I didn't really get when people talked about that stuff in here, and I didn't get it from my first few times doing a fourth step, even though I tried to be as thorough as I could be. But I've come to see in recent years how horribly affected I am by especially this grandiosity thing. Like, even when I'm trying to be a nice guy, I still picture myself as the center of the universe, you know, that I am more important, that I have more to say, that I have more to offer than anyone else. even the people I love and respect, you know. And so it's like a mindset. Anyway, not that that confession is going to do anyone any good. But there's a reason why alcohol felt so good to me, you know. Life was hard, and I didn't have a hard life. I didn't have anyone beating on me and calling me names and shit like that when I was growing up. I didn't have any of that stuff. But life was hard just living it being me because of the way I perceived everything and because of my insecurities and my abnormal fear of just criticism and judgments and stuff like that. It kept me from being a decent worker in any of the jobs I had. It kept me focused on me all the time. So anyway, Alcoholics Anonymous has given me a lot of opportunities to be focused on someone other than me. And only doing it, you know, out of self-preservation, but I've learned from that, if that makes any sense. That AA gives us a bunch of actions to take here that turns us into real human beings with real relationships with other real people. And I am real grateful for that part. I think I've about used up my time. It was not quite as amazing as the one I was thinking about giving for you. But it does me good to go through it and to remember, you know, where I came from, who I was when I came in here. You know, friends that are sitting here that just showed up to support me, and they've all heard me before. People came out to dinner with me tonight. What a life. I didn't have stuff like that. And I have so many riches now. And the thing is, being a part of AA, you can have as much as you want of all that. You know, there's a meeting going on all the time. You can always be in a meeting. And meetings for me continue to be something that lift my spirit, you know. If nothing else, they give me a vacation from this crazy thing for an hour at a time. But luckily, it's much more than that. There's more than that going on in AA meetings. And even if I disagree with everybody in the meeting, I know what I'm figuring out what I feel about things. I'm knowing what my God means to me and what sobriety means to me. And what the AA steps mean to me, and it's got to be, you know, it's not a me program, but you've got to internalize it if you want it. You know, you got to want this thing, and then it's like it's wide open. You can take it as far as you want. I don't know. I think I've said enough. It's nice to be here tonight. Thank you all for listening to me.
Thank you, Alan.